Morning, Your Honors. I'm Billy Guin. I'm court-appointed counsel for Tyrone Perkins. It would be my intent to talk to you today about two of the issues that I raised in my brief, the excessive disproportionate sentence that I believe that he received, as well as the erroneous enhancement of the sentence by 2 points.
Would you pull that mic over a little toward you?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Old ears.
We're all getting there. First of all, Your Honors, I think that when we look at the sentencings that were done on the various defendants in the case, you have an obvious disproportionate sentence. Mr. Elio Johnson received probation and 1 day in jail. Rakeisha Woodard received 1 day in jail and probation. Mr. McCullen, who was the head of the conspiracy, he was the mastermind, if you will. As Judge Hicks indicated, he was the master puppeteer of this situation, received 33 months. My client, Mr. Perkins, who was an underling at the bottom of the level of this situation, received 61 months, twice what the head of the conspiracy received. So we have an obvious disparity in the sentencing just on the numbers as we look at those. 18 U.S.C. 3553 advises us that the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities among defendants with similar records for similar conduct is a situation that the courts must look at.
But the ringleader pled guilty to 2 counts.
Correct.
Your client went to trial, was convicted on 18 counts.
Right.
So they're not similarly situated. Could you address that disparity?
Well, Judge, I think what we're looking at is the conduct that was, it doesn't really matter the way I'm looking at it as to what specific offense they pled to or were found guilty of. They were all involved in the same conduct.
Well, the ringleader also cooperated with the government.
Certainly, he did. And there's no doubt about that. And I think he should get a break, and he did, for cooperating. I'm just saying, and I think what we're looking at when we're talking about disparate sentencing is the extent of the difference in the sentencing. Certainly he gets a break, McCullen gets a break for cooperating. Mr. Perkins, my client, is going to be, in a practical sense, penalized for going to court and being found guilty and making the government go through the exercise of finding him guilty. But when we look at the difference in the sentencing and the amount of the sentencing, I think that's where we're looking at the disparate sentence situation. Usually what you see is the government going and getting the small fries to catch the big fish. Here the government caught the big fish first. And then he turns on everybody else down the line, and they're the ones that get caught up in the net.
Well, I guess, did you advise Mr. Perkins to go to trial?
That was Mr. Perkins' decision, Your Honor. He always professed his innocence to me as well as at court in trial. Our defense was that Mr. McCullen was a proven liar. He was proven to be a liar in court on numerous occasions under cross-examination and admitted to the jury that he was a liar.
But did your client deny that he was providing Social Security numbers and birth dates?
Very adamantly he denied that all the way down the line, Your Honor.
Well, so how did they get this information?
There were numerous ways that they could have gotten it, but my client was allegedly involved in this scheme after it was already ongoing. Mr. McCullen, the head of it, and another co-defendant, Mr. Wilfork, began this scheme. Mm-hmm. And it had been ongoing for several months, and they had access to the Social Security numbers of the servicemen from various other sources. One of them was another person that gave them Social Security numbers. They also had access through their own computers to get those Social Security numbers. Now, Mr. McCullen said he had a falling out with Mr. Wilfork, and then that access to those numbers supposedly went away.
Was Wilfork charged?
Excuse me?
Was Wilfork charged?
Yes, ma'am.
Did he plead?
I don't know. He was not involved in the trial that we had.
He didn't testify against your client?
No, he did not. The only person that testified against my client basically was Mr. McCullen. Again, like I said, my client adamantly denied being involved in this all the way down the line. So when Mr. Perkins, my client, is alleged to have gotten $200 for this scheme, and Mr. McCullen, the pre-sentence report indicated, got over $95,000, just the disparity in the amount of reward for the activity that was done is another indication that's apparent on the record. Mr. McCullen was much more culpable than my client. Mr. McCullen formulated the scheme. He applied for the loans. He got the money. He incorporated other people into the scheme to cash the checks, and he reaped the benefits.
Well, why don't you move on to your enhancement for obstruction of justice, though, because if that's your... If your pitch is an equity pitch, the judge thought that your client was testifying falsely.
That's correct, Your Honor. Judge Hicks made that decision. I believe that when you look at the record, that it's not clear on the record that my client committed a falsehood. What we're talking about is the access of the Social Security numbers and could my client get those out of the computer. My client testified that the procedure in the government and the military is that if you want to go that far to get that kind of information out of the computer, you have to have a supervisor that gives you that authority and the access to the computer. My client adamantly said, that's the way I always did it. That's what he testified to. I could not get that information from the computer because I didn't have that kind of access by my supervisor. Now, on cross-examination, the government asked him, well, if you wanted to circumvent the rules, if you wanted to not go by procedure, could you get that information? My client said, yes, I could. But that's not what I did. So I don't think that it's clear on the record that he actually lied. He told what he understood the procedure to be. He told what he did. If he wanted to, he could have gotten that information out. So I don't think it's clear that there was a perjury situation in this case. The second aspect of that part of the enhancement is the application for a loan that he went through to get a car. He did that. He applied for a loan. The only discrepancy in his testimony and the loan officer, he's talking about something 2 years before, is whether it was done in October or December. My client remembered one set of time frame. The officer said that's not when it happened. So I don't think it's clear.
All right, sir. You have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Washington.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I assume you will apologize for not knowing that the court starts at 9 and not 9:30.
That's correct, Your Honor. I do apologize. I've had my time mixed up. Actually, I was expected to be here 30 minutes early. I ran into a wreck on I-10, and it made me, I was going to be here at 9. And I decided to receive the phone call. I've been sitting outside my car, but I do apologize for that.
Well, I'm glad you called in any case. All right, sir.
Your Honor, the first issue I want to address to the court is dealing with the double hearsay that took place in this particular case. I'm going to list that as my first error with trial judge error.
Did you drive in from Shreveport this morning?
No, actually, I drove in last night, but I had a hotel on the other end, and that's what caused it.
Okay, sorry.
At any rate, the first error, which I outlined in my brief, was a double hearsay statement that was made by Mr. Johnson to the person who began this conspiracy, Mr. McCullough, about my client, Shannon Pillows. The statement that was made was basically stating that my client received or needed money for taxes and also paid some type of school tuition. And this was Mr. Johnson talking to Mr. McCullough in a home. And my client was not involved in that conversation, was actually in the room. Now, the problem that we saw and wrote in our brief is that it fell outside the scope of the conspiracy itself. If you look at what the government cited, the Delgado case, which lists out the four prongs in which a statement would be allowed by a hearsay statement be allowed, must be one, the existence of a conspiracy, two, the statement was made by a co-conspirator of the party, three, the statement was made during the course of the conspiracy, and four, the statement was made in furtherance of the conspiracy. There was two statements made. The second statement is the one that I identified in my brief, which stated that Mr. Johnson was speaking to Mr. Culler and asked, "What did Shannon Pillows tell you?" The court allowed him to state over defense counsel's objection what that Shannon Pillows told him.
And just for clarity, did Mr. Culler also testify to that?
Mr. McCullough.
This wasn't the only testimony to that fact, was there? I thought Mr. McCullough testified to the same.
Mr. McCullough testified to it, too.
So even if this was admitted erroneously, why isn't it harmless error if there was other testimony on the same issue?
Well, I think you have to look at each. Well, I understand you're saying harmless error, but in this case, if you compose all the errors that took place, I think the jury could have made a different decision if the court would have got it and made correct decision in saying that, hey, this was a hearsay statement and didn't allow it. Then at that point, you would only have Mr. McCullough making a statement, who is actually the person who started this conspiracy, who had to assist the government to help himself, and the jury could have made a different determination. Here you have Johnson, independent of McCullough, making a statement. So you have two people making a statement. If the court would have kept him in a box, if I may, and didn't allow his statement, you only had Mr. McCullough making a statement, and that's the difference. And my point is, it was outside the scope of the conspiracy because the conversation was, I need money for school and taxes, which based on the four prongs, it falls short and does not fit within that category. So as a result, I think the judge should have not allowed it. And secondly, the judge then, after the defense counsel made his objection, stated that in front of the jury that it's a co-conspirator statement, and in the presence of the jury. At that point, it was a sidebar. Counsel asked for a mistrial and it was lodged to the record. And at the end of the trial, the court could have instructed the jury.
At that point, after the sidebar, was there a request for a curative statement or instruction to be given to the jury?
From what I've seen, I think that request was made. Now, I was reading.
Is it on the record? I got the impression it wasn't made.
I'm looking at from the sidebar, it was an impression that it was, but I didn't literally see it. But from reading the sidebar, he asked for a mistrial, and I think they mentioned instructions, but there wasn't like an objection lodged into the record saying.
But at the end of the trial, co-conspirator instruction was given.
It was.
Right.
We just thought that it should have been a more specialized instruction to take place. And the second issue before,
was it objected to, that it wasn't specific enough?
I think it wasn't specific. I think it was just a general.
Was an objection made by counsel? Were you trial counsel?
No, I was not.
Okay, no objection.
And I didn't see that objection was made before the instruction was given to the jury. The second issue, also dealing with the witness, was the witness by the name of Jamari Freeman, where we looked at the right to confrontation, the Sixth Amendment, and alleged violation of the Confrontation Clause. In this case, counsel attempted to elicit questions about the witness' convictions, which he did. He then went in to ask questions about probation itself. Had he ever violated probation? And if so, and at that point, the judge said you can't ask him about probation and whether or not he violated. We felt that, after reading the record, that this limited the right to cross-examination. And for reading the government's brief, they cited U.S. versus Davis as one of the bases that the court can limit the cross-examination. And, I mean, we differ on that, and that in that U.S. versus Davis case basically dealt with city councilmen and the mayor, and it's who was indicted. And Samuel, a guy who testified against the city council and the mayor. The problem with that situation, which I think it fought, the government's brief falls short, and that is that the judge allowed testimony from Samuel as to who he lied to. The defense counsel allowed to cross-examine him to all different issues pertaining to the case. In our situation, to show that this guy had broken promises before, we were not allowed to ask those questions. And
it's not admissible under Rule 609. Is a probation violation admissible?
Well, and I look at that. The clear reading of, you know, actually combining 608 and 609, it appeared that there's a limit there. But if you review the case law, that limit, I think, sort of was expanded, like in U.S. versus Davis.
Wasn't it at best a matter of the trial court's discretion? I mean, because you already had that he had committed theft. So what would probation have added to that? Well, he violated probation, too. So, I mean, I'm not sure whether I agree with what the district court did, but even if he didn't do it, I mean, you've got the substance that attacks a guy's integrity, haven't you?
Well,
why was it not harmless error?
Well, I think it would show that this guy, Jamari Freeman, was pretty much independent of McCullough, who was the main person, and he was an important witness to the court. And I think we should have had wide latitude and cross-examining this guy. Why limit him in this particular situation? And we as Judge Clement stated, what about 609? But from reading the cases, it could have been allowed, should have been allowed, and it would have assisted the jury in understanding this witness himself.
You've used up your initial time.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. You have time for rebuttal, too.
Okay.
All right, Ms. Cassier.
Good morning, Your Honors. Just briefly to answer a question about Will Fork, he was indicted in the superseding indictment and pled guilty to the offenses. Addressing first the sentencing issue raised by Perkins, the sentence is not disproportionately high when you consider all of the aspects of 3553A, including the fact that McCullen did in fact cooperate and pled guilty to only two counts. And one of the two counts that he pled guilty to was a mandatory two-year term of imprisonment, which he did get. He received a break on his 5K1 for the other count.
This identity theft probably could seriously hurt the soldiers, couldn't it?
Your Honor, definitely did. Most of these soldiers in at Fort Polk at the time were preparing to go either to Afghanistan or Iraq. Some of them were actually deployed, I believe, after the fraud came to light, and they were having to deal with this. USAA was forced to become a little stricter about the way they dealt with these military requests for loans, and they did tighten up their policy. But before, it was much more lenient because of the need for the different soldiers and the rapid deployment that was going on.
Why wasn't McCullough, I guess McCullough was court-martialed too?
Your Honor, I don't recall what happened to McCullen, as far as the military goes.
It seems to me that in this situation, McCullen really did cut himself a really good deal, considering what he did and how he hurt the military.
I don't know what more they did. I know that we were intent on getting him, but we were most interested in the information that he gave because he did let the government know about a number of other people and did assist in prosecuting them.
Restitution paid?
Pardon?
Was any restitution paid?
I don't know if any restitution has actually been paid yet, but I know that all of the defendants were ordered to pay restitution in varying amounts. McCullen and Wilfork, I believe, were ordered to pay full amount for everything. The others, Perkins, Pillows, were only required to pay restitution in the amounts that they actually dealt with, the particular loans that they were involved in. Perkins was the inside person for getting the Social Security information and other personal identification information for the soldiers, and he was only held for those particular soldiers in the 509th, the particular division that he was in.
Been paid. I mean, an order of restitution is meaningless unless it's been paid.
That is correct, Your Honor. I do not know if they
would
they
you
have
address it. The supervisor issue, the explanation by Mr. Perkins that he couldn't access this information without a supervisor. Was that presented as something that was physically impossible or something that he was just morally obligated to ask the supervisor?
Your Honor, in his direct testimony, it appeared from what he said, the actual words of what he said, was that he had to have a supervisor actually standing over him and needed an additional password in order to access this information. Then on cross-examination, it became a little more muddied. It became, I could have, it would be possible to break the military rules and do this, but it was unclear whether he was obtaining the password illegally or if he was just by not having a supervisor standing over him, he was obtaining the information not according to military requirements.
But the difference was that he needed a code or something.
There was that impression,
exactly.
In his initial testimony, there was that impression. And then on cross-examination, it, in an attempt to clarify it, I think it became a little muddier. And you would have to read the testimony and get the sense of it. But the government also put on rebuttal testimony with regard to that particular aspect in which a supervisor, and I have forgotten the man's name right now, testified that he did not need any supervisory authority at all. He had access to this 24/7 and, in fact, could have been called and could have gone to whatever this building was where all of these computers were and gone to them through the back stairs and had access to this for any kind of an emergency situation. So he did not need a supervisor standing over him, nor did he need a special password. Also, the government put on rebuttal evidence that defendant had said that he had applied for a loan for this vehicle, and the loan that was illegally meant for him to purchase a vehicle was to occur in December. USAA, by that time, had caught on to certain addresses to which these checks were being mailed to, and so they did not complete the loan paper and document for that. So he did not get the money then. His defense was that he had applied for a loan with the Barksdale Federal Credit Union for this car. However, the loan that he applied for was about 3 months earlier in October. It was for a far lesser amount than the amount that he was going to get to purchase the vehicle in December. And so the government put that on to show that he was, in fact, lying about having applied for a loan for that particular vehicle from the Lemon Lot in December. So the government had two instances of that. And then at sentencing, the district judge made the finding that the defendant's insistence at sentencing that he had testified truthfully was, in the judge's own opinion, untrue and constituted obstruction of justice at the sentencing level. And so the judge found that the 2 points were properly given for both the testimony at trial and his insistence at the sentencing hearing that he had not, that he was telling the truth. With respect to the disproportionality, I believe that the cases that are cited by defense attorney, the Supreme Court cases deal with disproportionality between the sentence and the offense that we're talking about among defendants. And the other two cases from other circuits that the defendant cited are strange factual situations that really do not match up with the situation here. this defendant went to trial, obstructed justice, did not get his 3 points. He had a 5-point difference in his sentencing guideline, and did not cooperate in any way to the very end. Pillows complained about the co-conspirator statement, 801D2E. The first statement that was made, that Johnson testified that McCullen told him, that Pillows said that he needed money. That statement was not objected to at all at trial. It is the second statement that was made when the question was asked, what did he say, or why did he say he gave him the money? And that was objected to, and that's what prompted the objection. And the answer to that question was, he gave him the money for school and taxes. That is not prejudicial, really. It just gives a purpose. He gave him the money to buy a car, gave him the money to pay his rent. It's not prejudicial. At best, this is harmless error. That's the only way it could be interpreted as harmless, because there is so much other evidence against Pillows from so many other witnesses who were members of the conspiracy in this case. There was no request for an instruction, for a curative instruction at the time. So the judge simply gave his instruction at the end of the trial. Without any request for an instruction, the denial of an instruction makes no sense. And the reason this is a co-conspirator statement is because Johnson, McCullen, and Pillows were all shown by this point to be members of the conspiracy. Johnson and McCullen had just cashed a check illegally, and McCullen had paid off the people in the check-cashing place. He had paid off Johnson. He went back to the barracks, and in his room there were his friends, some of whom, Pillows was one of them, and he gave money there. So the circumstances are that he was dispersing money to fellow conspirators in this offense. So at best it was harmless. With respect to the limitation of cross, the sole purpose that he wanted to get the evidence in of the probation violation was to impeach the witness's credibility, his truthfulness. It was not to show his bias. He had been able to show what bias the witness had. But in this instance, he wanted to show that he was truthful, whether he was truthful or untruthful. And the rules of evidence, 608 and 609, govern that. Violation of probation is not admissible as a basis because it does not entail any element of truthfulness or untruthfulness, and it doesn't qualify. And again, even if it were to qualify, it was harmless error at best. Any further questions on anything else?
No, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Gwynn?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, there was no direct evidence put on at the trial that the identity theft had any direct evidence or any direct detrimental effect to the soldiers or their credit. The USAA, when they discovered these thefts, canceled some of the loans, denied some other loans, and presumably rectified the situation. So certainly there could have been harm to their credit rating possibly, but there was no evidence of that, as I recall, in the trial. Secondly, if you will, concerning the access to computer information and whether my client said that he had access, in my brief I noted the record at page 720, lines 13 through 22. I don't have that quote, but that's what in my brief about him admitting, as I recall, his access to that, as well as he admitted it on cross-examination. There are two cases that I cited on the disproportionate sentence issue. Flores, just some quotes from that case, they indicated that something fair in the overall scheme of things, when we look at the total sentencing, should be attributed by the court to these situations. And that appellate court said, quite properly, the district court was concerned about disparity among co-defendants, and that's exactly what we have. We've got one day in jail versus 61 months in jail on two defendants, and then, of course, McCullen with the sentence that he had being approximately half of what my client got.
But didn't the Third Circuit in Flores say the district court was under no obligation to avoid disparities when there are differing circumstances?
Every situation is different, Your Honor. But in this situation, I think it's just so apparent about the disparity that that it's obvious that, that something should be done.
All right,
thank you.
All right, sir, thank you. Mr. Washington?
Briefly, Your Honor, the prosecutor said that basically conceded if those errors are harmless, but if we look at the entire record, there was a number of harmless errors that I think in the totality of circumstances didn't allow the jury the opportunity to make a rational decision. From the first argument that it was outside the scope of the conspiracy, and I think it was, about the school and tax, it was outside the scope. The Jamari Freeman not being able to indulge into his cross-examination. I think, again, these errors led up to a conclusion that affected Shannon Pillows and Shannon Pillows' life. This, the third issue that I didn't speak about earlier was the compulsory process and not allowing the testimony of Mr. Green, who was a fellow soldier of Mr. McCullough, who would testify that, that was the third issue in my brief, who would have testified that Mr. McCullough spent a lot of time in Shreveport and was not at the the military base where he's supposed to be in line of formation, which the judge did not allow that. I think those type of situations added to the case for the government, and I think the court could have controlled that and allowed the cross-examination and also disallowed the introduction of hearsay statements, and we ask that the case be remanded in reverse.
All right. Thank you, sir.
You and this court reported if you were to say anything. You and this court.
Yes, right. Mr. Gwynn, I forgot to mention here you are court-appointed, and we know that you serve at less than your usual rate probably, and we thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it.
I'm okay.
You want to take a break?